Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. This morning I woke up and I was thinking, I don't know what I don't know. Now, that may sound philosophical, but
it's very zen.
Yeah, you know, there is years and years ago, there is like a 2x2 box. There's things you know, and there's things you don't know. And there's things that you know, and there's things you know you don't know. Like, I don't know how to do heart surgery, right? I know I don't know how to do that. And I do know how to tie my shoes. Well, 9 times out of 10, right? And I know how to do that. I know how to ride a bike. I know those things and I don't even think about it anymore. One way to phrase it is that I'm consciously competent at that. I can drive a car, and unfortunately, sometimes I don't think about it too terribly much, but I pay attention and drive and don't text and, you know, do all those kinds of things.
But you don't, do you fly a plane?
No, I don't know how to fly a plane, but I do know how to get on a plane.
But you know you don't.
I know I don't know how to fly a plane, yeah. Right? Okay. Now, unfortunately, I do know how planes fail.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And sometimes
I tend to block that out of my mind when I'm flying.
That's right. You deliberately choose to become you don't know, or whatever that phrasing is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've run into it, though, when you're working with a client or with a program team or a project team developing a product, that they say, well, how do we know how it's going to fail? Now, we know it's going to fail, but we don't know how. So you could say that's part of the, we don't know what we don't know, right? And there's the things that engineers love to work on are things they know about, right? We take them something that it breaks and they go, oh, okay, I can make that bigger or better or stronger or use different material. I can solve it once I know how it doesn't work, right? But when you tell them, here's a product, you need to make it better, they're going to look at you like, well, what? What do I change? What do I do? Right. So part of, I think, what we do in reliability is chip away or try to reveal what's in that bucket of what we don't know. We don't know. We deliberately probe that area in order to make it. We know something that we didn't know before. Have you ever run into that question?
I have. When I teach FMEA, for example, I always ask the students, and then if we're doing a project, I ask the team, how could this product be misused? What could go wrong that we're not even thinking about?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just touching on the edges of what you're talking about, because we consciously brainstorm how, you know, what we might have missed or how a product could be misused or what we're not understanding about this area. So I have some understanding of what you're talking about, but it's just a great topic because you're exploring using tools you do know. You're trying to explore things you don't know.
That's right.
And so it's not an easy topic.
Well, complaints or observations about FMEA, which I don't think is entirely true, as pushback to setting up and doing one of these sessions, was that you only have the knowledge of the people that are in the room with you, right? So you're only going to organize what you already know are problems. Now, I know that you've had the experience that that's not always true. As you put a team of, say, 6-7 people together, and they each come in with their top 3 or 10 things they know is a problem with the design or product or system or whatever is under study. And somehow, through that brainstorming, through the sharing of knowledge, that you actually do come out with things that the team would later say, oh, we didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I have... There's two things that I introduce into to use the FMEA application. One is I'll do that brainstorm outside the team. In other words, part of the preparation is I'll ask the facilitator, whoever's organizing the project, to canvas not only the people that are the subject matter experts on the team, but others outside the team as well, saying, what are your top three issues? What are you concerned about this particular project? And bring that in as input to the team. Secondly, of course, is, and this is not going to answer the topic, but is how things have failed in the past. We want to understand that because it can happen again.
That's right.
But that doesn't answer the question of what could happen that you're not worried about or not thinking about.
Right. Now, so FMEA, I don't think is aimed directly at figuring out what you don't know yet. Yet it helps in that realm.
On the edges.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. A well-facilitated FMEA will reveal some of those areas. So that's one tool for that. In the discussion about what are you concerned about, or, you know, your prompt of, well, how could people misuse this product, reminds me of Adam Barrett's use case 7, right? Let's take it to the extreme. And I think it's a technique in brainstorming is to go to the ludicrous, right? Take it way out.
Yes.
But then what comes out of that is some realization that, oh, wait a second. You know, if we back that off a little bit, that does affect a lot of people. That really could happen. And it, again, is touching on those edges of what we don't know.
Well, let's add that as a tool, which is brainstorming. FME is a tool. Brainstorming is a tool.
In and of itself, yeah.
In and of itself, exactly. You can brainstorm with or without FMEA. And if you do it well, like you're describing, you'll hit the edges of this this void as well.
That's right. Yeah, void's a good description of it. But what we're really talking about is when you're setting up a program or you're at a stage going, well, how are we going to know when it's ready, right? And electrical engineers are going to say, well, I get 5 volts at this spot and it does this function and it does this timing correct. And here's my engineering requirements. From a reliability point, we may say, well, we need to know, well, how's it going to fail? What stresses is it going to see? And then we can work out or test for time to failure, but we need to know how it's going to fail. Electrical and mechanical engineers typically need to know where the weaknesses are. And sometimes they have a good idea, but other times they're surprised. And I think this whole idea of understanding what we don't know is risk identification. It's the larger picture of what's uncertain about our project or design. Risk is, I'm using a synonym for uncertainty. So will this work? There's uncertainty there. That's a risk.
Let me just explore that with you for a minute, just as a sidebar, because I've been doing some thinking about this and some writing about it. So I've been looking at the subject of risk, and you were saying risk is uncertainty. So some definitions, if we go to ISO 31000, risk is the effect of uncertainty on objectives. And an effect is a positive or negative deviation from what is expected. So we're very close to the uncertainty. So it's the effect of uncertainty on objectives is a very general statement. There's much more about the subject, obviously, if you get into the other types of standards.
Well,
so
yeah.
I wanted to kind of sidebar on that.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. Is I shorthand it to uncertainty, but it's if we're... it kind of reminds me of Schrodinger's cat, you know, it's in a box and you don't know if he's alive or dead. But in a design team, we're being asked to make a decision. And I'll use the example of, all right, let's go to production and ship this product, right? Let's freeze the design and let's go make it. Well, there's still a pile of uncertainty around, is it robust enough? Is it resilient enough? Is it strong enough? Is it going to function as expected long enough, our reliability part, in and among many, many other elements of that uncertainty. And a lot of what we do during development from modeling and simulations and testing and so on is to chip away at that uncertainty and answer those questions. So at the end of the program, we can say, yep, our risk to going to market is low, because the uncertainty for a negative outcome, saying that it'll fail on arrival or fail after, you know, very quickly, is reasonably low. But we have to be able to quantify that in some form or fashion, right? We have to, that it all starts with, well, what are the risks? There's been way too many examples, and I'm sure all of our listeners have examples in mind where you install a piece of equipment, or you fire up a new program, or you ship a new product, and 2 months later you slap your head, your hand into your forehead, going, "Why didn't we catch that? Why didn't we know that?" That's the part that I think we all are. Relatively good at understanding the risks that we know about.
The known risks.
Right. The trouble is that the ones that get us are the ones we don't know about. And so I feel it's a part of the reliability role, and you could argue that it's a part of any engineer's role, is to understand the full scope of presenting risks and especially the negative outcomes, but positive outcomes, you can take advantage of those. And so FMEA and brainstorming are two tools to getting at that a little bit.
So let's look at some other tools. We want to understand design margins. And in other words, you don't want to introduce a product that's right on the edge of failure. So you pass the test, but you just barely passed it, but you don't know that you just barely passed it.
Right.
And so one of the things I learned early on, and I'm sure you've had the same, and we have lots of stories, I'm sure, is the subject of design margin. Yeah. How much margin do we have? Sometimes called safety factor, other nomenclatures. But the idea is, how far away from the anticipated use can you be before you fail?
Yeah. You know, and part of that, and you use this example, is the Brooklyn Bridge, right? They completely over-designed it. And it was because of the expected variability in the steel that were I think it was steel that was used for the cabling, right?
Yes.
The designer suspected the steel manufacturers of cheating or not providing the best quality stuff. So it made it just like twice as big or three times as big or whatever it was. And those, and it's still standing.
Still standing.
Right. So we do that safety margin, design margin has its roots in the understanding that our materials and manufacturing processes and use conditions all have variability. And instead of quantifying and characterizing all of that, which will continue to be elusive, we just make it more robust than it needs to be to accommodate those uncertainties.
Yeah, and some companies have safety factors. I was at one company that used a 1.9, not sure where they got that from. Others a 2.0. Yeah. Some people advocate 3. But this comes down to trade-offs. Because, for instance, if you're trying to launch a rocket ship, you have to take into account weight.
Right.
As a huge factor. I mean, everybody has to take into account weight, but that launch load. So your safety factor is going to be modified, or you have to consider the weight factor as well when you do that. There's competing analyses that come into play, because otherwise we'd say, well, if we didn't have to worry about cost and we didn't have to worry about weight, then just over-design everything by 10,
right,
and you'll never have a problem.
Well, I have that.
But you can't do that.
Yeah, well, you can. It's called a cast iron pan that it'll survive generations, right? And you just a modest amount of maintenance, and it's a great tool. But it's completely over-designed. Yeah, I have trouble lifting it sometimes. But in some markets, some applications, that's to be expected. But we wouldn't want to be driving a Bradley tank every time we wanted to go get groceries.
Right.
There's always trade-offs, and cost and weight are two examples. The the uncertainty part, though, still exists, right? The variability that exists out there. So safety margins and factors and so on. And now back to design margins, I'm thinking of Kirk Gray here, where he would say, well, run a halt.
Now, exactly.
I think there's two parts to that. There's one is, well, what stresses, right? And mm-hmm. and so a good halt program involves the first step is not just go buy a halt chamber or rent one. It's, well, what stresses do you want to apply? And that's another case for a brainstorm. And back to like a use case 7 scenario or an FMEA to say, well, what are the stresses not only that are we expect to be applied to our product with some severity to them, with some harshness to them, or some extremes to them, but what stresses do we expect to see applied to our product that we don't know a lot about, right?
Yes, and so you have, and again, this, I think what we're saying is that you can do all of the above. In other words, you can brainstorm, you can use HALT, you can use FMEA, and then you're going to be chipping away at this uncertainty because you'll have to use brainstorming as part of your HALT procedure to determine what types of stresses and what values you're going to be introducing.
Yeah, and it's so those are a range of tools for it. I think another one that we often see happen, but I don't even think it has a name to the tool, is that you get a prototype and your marketing manager takes a look at it and goes, what if, or the electrical engineer says, what happens when?
Yeah, exactly. Let's characterize there's a set of tools under a use case. In other words, the human interaction or how a product is used. And it from a concept, I think I like to look at it as anticipated misuse. Mm-hmm. And I always want to know when we're designing a product or analyzing a product or doing an FMA or anything else, what's the anticipated misuse? And understand that and try to consider that as part of the design or part of the failure anticipation.
Well, and that overlaps into the safety realm, right? If the, and I don't think it's just the misuse. I think it does need a characterization. I always get pushback on those kinds of questions though, of, well, we're not designing for people to misuse it, right? Well, you need to design it so that the expected common misuses, which really aren't the misuse at that point,
right,
is that we need to accommodate that. And if we do end up with something that's a breakthrough or a clever way of solving that problem, then we've got a market leader. There's some upside to solving those kinds of problems, expanding your market. You know, the trouble with that, Carl, is that our customers continue to be more creative in how they misuse a product.
They do. And so there's always a catch up, always trying to catch up to how it could be misused. I remember years ago, you can remember when you spill your glass of water, God forbid, Coca-Cola on your keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the end of it. Yep. Instantly.
Yep.
And now there's like ways to mitigate and address or anticipate and design so that some type of moderate misuse doesn't overly damage the product.
Yeah. My daughter spilled a glass of milk under her keyboard one time and the keyboard kept working, but it smelled really bad. It was not an expected failure mechanism for a keyboard. No, it's bad smell.
You have to spray it with something, which could also...
Yeah, eventually I think she tried cleaning it a couple of ways and then that did kill it. So ended up mm-hmm. with a keyboard.
So different tools to anticipate the product interaction, usage or misuse, however you want to characterize it.
Well, those would be helpful. You know, there's also that exercise of just the day in the use, day in the life of it, the expected mm-hmm. use. Did we capture all of the stresses? Did we capture all of the activities and so on? And many times that becomes that early alpha program or beta program where you give it to people and say, how do you use it? What worked well, what didn't work? It's even for functionality. It's all those kinds of things.
And let's not forget the design review of requirements, the review of requirements to see if they're adequate, mm-hmm. where you bring in a different set of eyes.
Yep.
Because if you're designing a nuclear power plant, near an ocean, and then you want to obviously consider what could happen, what kind of event, like a tsunami, are you designing to withstand? Yeah. And the people may or may not have considered all of the factors that go into that or enough. And that's an extreme example, but any product has requirements, and whoever developed the requirements may have missed things. And so that's part of the unknown, where a design review of a different set of eyes looking at things, sometimes you can chip away at that unknown.
Yeah, it's, you know, all in all of these different tools provide different views or angles into exploring this space, right? This void that we keep mentioning. I think a big part of it, though, is that the overall culture of the organizations needs to be aware of that we don't know all what we need to know. We have to be inquisitive, curious, open to brainstorming, open to what-if scenarios, paying attention to any anomaly that we see in simulations or modeling or prototypes. That if we're of the old school, design it to spec, and the spec is always right, and if we do that, we're good. I think that attitude blinds us to what of looking for what we don't know.
And that's that's a great point. So you want to start with that, call it humility. Mm-hmm. That there's things you don't know, and that's really an important starting point.
Yeah, and we mentioned a handful of tools that can help you chip away at that. Now I'm curious though. I just have this sense or feeling that there are other ways to go about doing this. You know, and I'm thinking just even more broadly of like scenario planning. You know, in business planning, I wonder if there's an equivalent in product design.
Let's ask our listeners.
Yeah, that's what my thought was. Is, you know, I'm struggling a little bit with the set of tools because I don't feel like any of them are dead on to get at this unknown piece and chip away at it. So, what's your experience? What have you found works or doesn't work, and what combination maybe has cracked this open for you or have a good success area for it? Or if you see barriers to it, maybe that's another angle that you'd like us to explore some more. And because we certainly work with teams that were resistant to doing this kind of stuff. But let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can also find us on LinkedIn. You can find ways to contact us through our about pages on Ascendo. So you've got plenty of options. We certainly would love to hear from you. So, Carl, you got any big risks coming up today? Anything you need to be aware of?
We're in the market for new windows for our house.
Oh yeah,
that's a fertile field for risk.
That's right. Yeah. Good luck with that. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll talk to you offline. I was an expert witness related to that topic.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Thanks.
Nice chatting with you, Fred.
Yeah. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.